This is Election 2016 special coverage on 90.3 KAZU. I'm Krista Almanzon. Tonight, in partnership with the Monterey County Weekly, we bring you a debate between 20th District Congressional candidates, Republican Casey Lucius and Democrat Jimmy Panetta. They're running for the congressional seat that represents all of Monterey and San Benito counties, as well as part of Santa Cruz and Santa Clara counties. The seat is currently held by Congressman Sam Farr, who is retiring after 23 years in office. The debate took place Monday, September 19th at the Press Club in Seaside before a live audience. Here's debate moderator, Monterey County Weekly interim editor, Sarah Rubin.
All right, so let's start out with the softball question. We keep reading about how Congress has its lowest approval ratings in history. Why do you want this thankless job?
That's a softball question. Thank you. Thank you to the Weekly for hosting this and for all of you for spending your time out here listening to us. This is a really important election because, as Sarah indicated, it has been 23 years since this seat has been open. And this district has never been represented by a woman. So I think this is a really exciting time for all of you to really have a say in this election. And I'm glad you're all here to listen to the issues and listen to our policy positions and be informed voters. It is true that Congress has about a 14% approval rating right now, which is pretty bad. And clearly, Washington is broken. Clearly, something is not working. It's not working for the American people, and it's not working for this community. And the reason I decided to run for this office is because the time that I have spent in local public office, and even on county boards and commissions, we have been talking about the same issues over and over and over again. We talk about widening Highway 156. We talk about traffic on Highway 1. We talk about the need for water, the need for affordable housing. We talk about protecting the environment. We talk about the need for immigration reform for our agricultural and our tourism industries. And yet, those issues never seem to get resolved. We talk about them year after year after year, which is why I suspect Congress has a 14% approval rating, because the issues never get resolved. And I want to go to Washington and actually present solutions, practical solutions, and get things done for this district. Thank you.
Thank you. Obviously, thank you, Sarah. I appreciate this opportunity to be here. Thank you to the Monterey County Weekly, Bradley and Eric. And thanks to all of you for coming out tonight. I appreciate this opportunity for you to get to know me and me to get to know you. And obviously, thank you to Casey Lucius for being here as well. First, let me just start by addressing one thing, and that is, I don't know if you've seen it. I know my daughters have, and my wife
Jimmy,
has.
Can you just lean in?
My daughter has, and you know, my wife has. They've seen a commercial that's been put on by Miss Lucius recently, and some say it's pretty negative. I got to tell you, I just want to let you know that I will not resort to that, and I will be above that negative type of campaigning. I understand. I will answer the question, but I wanted to make sure that you understand how I am committed, just like I told Ms. Lucius early on, that I'm committed to running a positive campaign, and I will continue to be throughout the general election. Now, in regards to why I want to run for Congress, I want to be the representative of this area. Sarah, I get that question every single time I'm out there. That is the number one question. There is a lot of dysfunction in Washington, D.C. We've had a Republican leadership that has failed to do much. And when it comes to policy, being from here, I understand that the most important issue is having comprehensive immigration reform, and it needs to get done. We need to have a president who's willing to do it. You need to have a representative that's willing to focus on comprehensive immigration reform, and you need to have a Speaker of the House who's not just going to talk about it, but actually do something about it. But let me tell you what's most important about running for Congress. It's the fact that I can serve people right here in my hometown. You don't understand how often I hear stories of people coming up to me, making a point not to talk about Washington, D.C., but to talk about the service they received right here in the district from their Congress member, be it an immigration issue, be it an affordable housing issue, be it a benefits issue. And these were stories that took place over 20, 30, 40 years ago. Yet they make it a point to tell me about it. Because in this position, you can actually affect people's lives. You can actually give them the opportunity for a better life. And that's why I'm running for Congress.
I appreciate the enthusiasm, but let's try and hold applause and we'll have a chance for audience participation. So I want to ask about our community's Congressional District 20's military footprint. Mm-hmm. We keep hearing that there's going to be another BRAC commission in that whoever is elected will, their tenure may coincide with that. That's base realignment and closure, the process that resulted in the closure of Fort Ord. Do you advocate to keep all of our existing military installations open, or are there some that you would say should close? What is the strategy for how you approach that? Let's start with Jimmy on this one.
Sure. Yes, you do. Look, I had the opportunity to meet with someone who, he actually had a conversation with an Assistant Secretary of Defense who was here recently a couple weeks ago. And this person told me that the Assistant Secretary of Defense, his words were, man, you have a gold mine here. And the people in the building, that five-sided building out there in Washington, D.C., they need to know about it. And so we need to make sure, we need to educate people about the mission of our installations and about Monterey. Look, we have 12 military installations. We do have a lot here in Monterey. There's no doubt about that. But we have to show that it's cost-effective to have all of them here, how interdependent they are on one another, how interdependent that the city of Monterey and the surrounding communities are dependent on those installations and vice versa. $1.5 billion to the economy, I think 35,000 jobs to this area. They're very important, but most importantly, we need to get the mission out there. We need to tell people how invaluable it is to this area. Look, no longer is our military just about planes, tanks, and guns. It's about education, it's about leadership, it's about cybersecurity, it's about languages, it's about the weather. We have all of those here, including Fleet Numerical, there's someone from Fleet Numerical that's here today, and Navy Postgraduate School. They are important to the mission of the military, and we need to make sure that we let people in Washington, D.C. know about the missions here. Look, when we want people thinking about, when they think about the future of our military, they're thinking about Monterey County. That's what it comes down to, and that's the message that all of us have to get out there.
Well, actually, I think that just getting the message out about how important our bases are here in Monterey County will not be enough. Because the truth is, last April, DOD did a capacity study of all of the bases that they have all over the world. And then in May, they reported the results of that study to Congress. And what that report said was that in the educational category, so in the schoolhouse category, they have 44% over capacity. And both DLI and NPS are in the schoolhouse category, which makes them vulnerable to base closure. So that's not a happy story to tell, but it's an important story that we have to be mindful of, and we have to go in this with all of the facts and all of the information. So just talking about how great Monterey is isn't going to be enough. I believe what we have to do to really protect our bases is we have to open up the gates. We have to make them community assets. People talk all the time about the gates around DLI used to be open for transit through the Presidio from Pacific Grove into Monterey. That's now closed, which causes all sorts of congestion for our local residents. But also around NPS, you know, NPS has a research library that should be open to Ms. students, to the law students, to CSUMB students, and yet it's not because everything is shut down because of security. And I'm a national security expert, so I appreciate that and I understand those challenges. But I think the best way that we can make our bases the best assets to our community are to take the gates down and really make them community assets. And I would also say that there are actually 8 criteria that Congress looks at to determine which bases will be closed. One of those criteria is employment for spouses. And unfortunately, this isn't an easy place for spouses to be employed. So local business owners, I would encourage all of you to try to hire military spouses. Another thing they look at is healthcare access, and they also look at education and the rankings for schools. So it's a community effort. It's not just about how beautiful Monterey is, but it's really making our bases assets and working on all of those other sectors as well.
So I want to follow up because I hear Jimmy say that the military is no longer planes, tanks, guns. I guarantee you,
Say no longer, just.
No longer.
No longer about, just about.
There's another one of these forums happening somewhere in this country right now for some other congressional district where they manufacture one of those things, and it's the big employer, and they are saying the military is no longer about teaching languages. It's all about the thing that we do, the new high-tech, whatever it is that we make. Mm-hmm. Is there going to be some downsizing of the military? Should there be? And where should that shrinking come from? If it's not going to be here, where do you recommend there are going to be cuts if we're going to keep all of our installations intact? And let's start with Casey on this one. We can switch back and
forth. Great. I love this question because I've spent a lot of time thinking about this very question. Because the truth is, this question doesn't just speak to our local military bases or the future of the military, or how to cut the DoD budget, but it also speaks to how do we really rein in federal spending. And I believe the only way to do that is to really, really look at the DoD budget and think about how we can reform spending within DoD. And I believe the best way to do that is to downsize the military, but to do it smartly. We have a very capable military, and currently, this is a little bit complicated, but currently the way the military is organized is we take a map of the world and we divide it into regions. So we have an Africa region, we have a European region, North America, South America, Asia, etc. And each of those regions essentially has their own command. They have their own little military with ships and aircraft and platforms and personnel, and it's very expensive. So we're not really operating one military. We're operating six militaries all over the world. But when you look at the threats that we are facing as a nation, when you think about climate change, when you think about cybersecurity or even terrorism, those are threats that are not bound by geography, they're not bound by borders. So I believe we need to completely restructure and reform DoD away from that geographical structure into a functional structure. So we focus on having a counterterrorism command, a cyber command. We do have a task force climate change. But in other words, that way we can work smarter, we can work more effectively and efficiently and cut the DoD budget and make sure that we're using our military appropriately.
No, look, I appreciate Casey's answer. I think that's a smart answer. But I also know from my experience and being in Afghanistan and actually serving with a special operations unit that was responsible for being the counterterrorism unit there in Afghanistan and looking outwardly, that we do need to downsize and we need to specialize and we need to do it in a smart way. You see what's going on in the Middle East now. We do not need conventional forces on the ground. What they instead did was make sure that they had targeted special forces to go after the targets. That's bolstering their intelligence capabilities. That's making sure that we have the intelligence capabilities to find that target, to fix it, and then go forward and do the following mission. They continued with these targeted airstrikes, but making sure that they had special forces to basically lock in and make sure they were going after the right person. So it's not about expanding. We're at a point, as we've seen recently, as I saw firsthand in Afghanistan, it's about shrinking it down, making sure it's done not just bigger, but it's done smarter.
I want to talk a little bigger picture on foreign policy while we're on this subject of military and a little bit about our country's military presence in the world. We have all these evolving threats that we all know about. Still, I think officials are trying to figure out what happened in New York and if there's any connection. The U.S. has effectively been at war in the Middle East since 2001 with the invasion of Iraq. How would you rate the success of that investment, all the time and money since then? Is the U.S. now safer than it was then? How are we doing? Let's start with you.
Sure. And Sarah, you were just talking about the invasion of Iraq. Is that what you said?
That's one starting point. Yeah. But okay. You can start at a different point in history if you'd like to answer that question.
Look, I think, you know, based on the unfortunate attacks of September 11th, and, you know, we have continued to deal with an ongoing threat, be it on September 11th, be it yesterday with the pipe bombs that were put in and the pressure cooker bombs that were put in New York City, and fortunately nobody was killed as far as I know. And so it's a constant battle. There is a clear and present danger that we are having to confront, not just here in our country, but obviously in the Middle East as well. And we continue to do that by basically making sure that our administration is leading, making sure that they have the diplomatic efforts to reach out and hopefully have other Middle East countries be a part of it, join the fight. And then we need to make sure that we continue to focus on the high-value targets, as they were doing. Now, I know Ms. Lucius has basically wanted 20,000 troops on the ground, up to 20,000 troops on the ground. I think that's the worst thing they could do. You're playing right into their hand when you do that. And you need to make sure you continue doing it the way they're doing, and basically with a targeted special forces type of attack. And that's what we've been doing. We also need to continue to fuse our intelligence in Europe, and we need to make sure that we can do it here in the United States. Look, no matter how much security and no matter how much we've spent in the Middle East, it still didn't stop us from missing this guy and this group that planted these pressure cooker bombs in New York just recently. It didn't stop a mother and father from preparing their arsenal down in San Bernardino while their six-month-old kid was in the next room. It takes everybody involved. We cannot push the Muslim community away. We need to take them in. And because it's people that will basically around these people who become radicalized, you make sure that there's other people there who come forward, who notice it, who come forward and talk to authorities. It's unfortunate that we have continued to have this long, drawn-out battle that we're facing in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and unfortunately here in the United States. But that's what it's come to at this point, and that's what we're having to deal with, and we need to continue to fight it at all levels, not just at the administration level, not just militarily, but all of us need to be vigilant.
Casey?
Regarding the question of how would you rate the success of the Iraqi war, on a scale of 1 to 10, I would say 1. In terms of success, and whether or not we're better off or safer today, the answer for me is absolutely not. And I believe the reason for that is because we currently have a misguided foreign policy, and we have an absence of a national security strategy. What I would like to see from the next president, and I haven't heard this from any of the candidates, is an articulation of our national interests. I would love for someone to say, and I can tell you what I think they are, but I would love for someone at the presidential level to say what our national interests are, what we stand for as a nation, and what it is we are willing to fight for and defend. No one really knows what that is. So as a result, we are just constantly reacting to these little crises all over the world. And when it comes to ISIS, specifically ISIS, because Jimmy's misquoting me, saying that I call for 20,000 troops in Iraq in response to ISIS. In fact, my criticism of President Obama has been that he has only used special operations and airstrikes in Iraq. He has only used the military because he's treating the military as our only option. Instead of using our cyber capabilities, instead of using economic sanctions against the countries that are buying oil from ISIS, instead of using strategic communications to compel our allies to fight ISIS, instead of using local law enforcement and intelligence agencies, he is only using the military. And my criticism is he's using the military and he's doing it half-ass. So that's not working. It's not working for our country. We don't have a national security strategy. We don't have a foreign policy. And anything going forward should be grounded in our national interests.
Before we move away from military, I want to just ask, and maybe we could do shorter answers on this one. FORA is the Fort Ord Reuse Authority is currently scheduled to sunset in 2020, and it will be up to the state legislature, not to Congress, whether to extend FORA again or whether it, you know, goes away after it sunsets. But I wonder if you could each talk about what you would like to happen with FORA come 2020, and what kind of vision from Washington will you advocate as far as the ongoing cleanup of that former base, and what would you deliver? What's your strategy to deliver it to our community here? So let's start with Casey on this one.
Yes, I currently serve on the FORA board, and that's quite interesting. It's a bit dysfunctional, as most of you know, and it's been many years without a lot getting done, so much like Congress, actually. It is anticipated, according to state legislation, to sunset, essentially to close out the agency in 2020. And I believe that that should happen. There have been some advocates that we should continue the organization, continue until the blight is removed, until we do complete environmental cleanup and rebuild the base. I just, based on my short time on that board, I will tell you it will take 100 years if that agency stays in place. I actually believe that it should be disbanded and that the land itself should be given back to the municipalities. The way Fort Ord is divided is there's county land, there's City of Marina, City of Seaside, City of Delray Oaks, and I believe that that land should be within the jurisdiction of the municipalities and allow those city councils to make the decisions for what is best for their territory. My own personal vision is that we should use that for affordable housing. We have a real lack of affordable housing here, and I don't just mean Section 8 apartments or HUD-funded housing, but I mean actually building homes that people can afford to buy in this district. Because even people who are living here with two incomes or with good jobs, college graduates, can't afford to buy a home here. And it's really unfortunate. And as a result, we have a lot of talented people leaving this area because they simply cannot afford to live here. So I would really hope that the municipalities then would invest in building affordable housing on that land.
The problem is that I think there are many people who will echo Casey's sentiment about the dysfunction of Fora. But the problem is that you have an ongoing munitions cleanup, you have the conservation habitat plan, and you have a $50 million insurance policy that I'm not sure if there's a political will amongst the municipalities surrounding Fort Ord to step up and take that. I have not seen that. I have not heard that. And that is a question that needs to be answered by all of the cities before anything's done come 2020.
Let's talk about immigration. We last reported an estimated 55,000 undocumented immigrants in Monterey County. Many of them are coming from Mexico, and we hear one of the leading presidential candidates proposing to build a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. What immigration reform policy would you advocate for in Congress, and what's your strategy to get it done? Let's start with Jimmy on this one.
Thank you, Sarah. Look, from the very beginning, growing up here, you understand how important immigration is to this community, how important it is to our country. I mean, as a grandson of Italian immigrants, I understand how vital it is to have the opportunity to come to this country and take advantage of the rights that this country lets you exercise by giving your children a better life. And when you go out there and you speak with farmers and farm workers, it's comprehensive immigration reform. Not just one bit, not just picking it apart here and there. It's making sure that it's comprehensive. And people always say, oh, well, you sure are optimistic if you think that you can get that done in Congress. Say, look, they've done it before. 2013, the US Senate had Senate Bill 744. It provides a framework upon which the Congress can use. Unfortunately, the Republican-led Congress didn't even sniff it. They blocked it. And we're stuck with the situation that we have today, with farmers and farm workers basically complaining about the system. That comprehensive immigration reform dealt with border security, put billions into border security. It dealt with changing the visa process, H-2As and H-1Bs. And it provided a pathway to citizenship, a very difficult pathway to citizenship, actually 13 years of a path. During that time, you had to have no felonies, no misdemeanors, learn English, have a job, make sure you have a place to live, and you become a registered immigrant, a legalized immigrant, then you can become a naturalized citizen. And you know what? After 13 years of doing that, you bet you should have that opportunity. And the fourth thing they advocated for is investment in youth jobs. It's a compromise. That was a compromise. It was what you heard the Gang of Eight, those presidential Republican contenders, nominees, running away from, because it was a compromise. And how do we do this? How are we going to have that compromise coming up in 2017? First of all, you elect me. Second of all, you elect Hillary Clinton, who said that that's the first thing she's going to do. And third, if the Speaker of the House is Paul Ryan, you make sure he stops talking and rolls up his sleeves and gets something done. That he's not worried about his presidential intentions, but he's concerned with being a good Speaker of the House. That's the job. We go to D.C. to get something done. And comprehensive immigration reform is the most important thing we can do for this community and for this country. It's an economic thing, it's a humane thing, and it is an American thing that I look forward to working on.
Casey?
Yes. Comprehensive immigration reform is absolutely what we should strive for. And the Republicans in Congress have blocked that. And this is an area where I disagree with my party. I also disagree with Donald Trump when he talks about building a wall. The good news is I disagree with my party. I'm the first one to admit that. There are lots of areas where I disagree with my party. Unlike my opponent, who has been quoted as saying, there is nothing he disagrees with Hillary Clinton on. Nothing. Even Hillary Clinton disagrees with Hillary Clinton because she changes her mind all the time. So how could you say you don't disagree with anything with a presidential candidate? So we absolutely should strive for comprehensive immigration reform. The question in my mind is, how do we get it done? So just talking about it and saying, like, well, let's use an old 2013 bill. It didn't work in 2013. It's probably not going to work in 2017. I really believe we need H-2A visa reform. And we can start with H-2A visa reform and move on to H-2B visa reform, H-1B visa reform, and if we change these visa categories to meet the industry needs, we can accomplish comprehensive immigration reform. But we do it in a way that is not ideological, it's not partisan, it's not overwhelming, and we can actually accomplish it. And I'll just give you an example. Agriculture is our number one economic driver in this district. And nationwide, the ag industry needs 3.2 million H-2A visas. Congress has set the cap at 140,000. So Congress needs to get involved and make sure that they work with the industry to get that number right. So that's the first change that we need to make. And that doesn't require a comprehensive overhaul. We did comprehensive healthcare reform, and it's a mess. So I think we need to be really careful about comprehensively reforming anything and really look at it in chunks that we can get done.
So I want to ask each of you a follow-up question. Casey, do we need comprehensive immigration reform, even if that's not where we start? Do you
Absolutely.
Think we need it? And then if that's not where you start, when do you get there? And what would trigger that? And should there be a pathway to citizenship at some
Absolutely.
Point?
Absolutely. Absolutely, we need comprehensive immigration reform. Absolutely, there should be a pathway to citizenship. By the way, we have a pathway to citizenship now. Maybe that needs to be reformed to address anyone who's currently living in the country illegally, but we do need to have a pathway to citizenship. We need to make sure that everyone in this country has the opportunity to live here and work here legally. And that's why they need work visas to be here legally. Once they have work visas to live here and work here legally, then they can be on a path to citizenship. And we absolutely can accomplish that. But I think if you just start by overwhelming everybody about comprehensive immigration reform, which no one can agree on, what all of that includes, it will never be accomplished. It's like fora. So let's focus on what we can actually get done.
I love that fora has become the default dis for a dysfunctional piece of legislation. I hope no one else from the fora board is here, but they probably agree with you anyway.
Sarah, they did agree on comprehensive immigration reform. The US Senate agreed on it in 2013. It was the Republican leadership that blocked it. People can agree on comprehensive immigration reform. She's saying comprehensive, but then she's saying, no, 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 let's just do this one little part. No, you go in there, you go what can be done. That bill provided that framework that we can follow. And I'm telling you, California can be a leader when it comes to this. Democratic the Democratic representation here on the coast of California, we want it. The Republican representatives in the Central Valley, they say they want it. It's time for them to step up and do it. And I believe that the California delegation, Republicans and Democrats, can lead on this issue. I've spoke with Jeff Denham. Jeff Denham and I talked about this issue. And I told him, look, we have the same concerns. He's a Republican, the only Republican congressman that borders our district. And I told him we have the same concerns, we have the same issues. This is the type of Congress member I'm gonna be, and we can work together on these issues. And he agreed, and he appreciated that. And that's what it takes. It takes relationships. It takes reaching across the aisle in order to, yeah, you bet, we're going to shoot big when it comes to immigration. We're going to shoot for comprehensive immigration reform because it's been done and it can be done again.
So if I may respond to that, because Jimmy will say a lot of different congressmen and undersecretaries that he's been meeting with and talking to. I don't talk to congressmen and undersecretaries of anything. I'm actually spending my time talking to the people who live in this district, including the growers who own the farms in the Salinas Valley, including the field workers. And the one thing that they say to me is it is so cumbersome to apply for an H-2A visa. There's a housing requirement that goes with that, and yet they can't build housing because of local density regulations. There's healthcare requirements that go with it. It is a very cumbersome process. There are fees and taxes that go along with it. And then even when they do apply and get the visas they need, usually they come 6 months late for a 10-month visa, and they don't get the number that they need. So something's not working. We need to actually tackle the problems that we can solve, and we need to make sure that the solutions we offer can actually be achieved.
I want to move on. We touched on agriculture to a specific agricultural question. One of the great environmental achievements of the past decades has been the Montreal Protocol 1987 that set forth a plan to phase out ozone-depleting chemicals. One of the chemicals that has an exemption to that is methyl bromide, which is used still on the Central Coast all across this district to fumigate strawberries. Every time there's a renewal opportunity, that exemption is extended. Would you support continued exemptions for methyl bromide, or would you like to see it phased out, and on what timeline? Let's start with Casey on this one.
So I will say this is an issue that I would be open-minded about because I don't know the specifics of methyl bromide, and I would want to make sure that I thoroughly research it and understand it before I make any kind of decision like that. So I think it's important to stay open-minded on all issues. But I will say that there is a program called Responsible Ag, and Responsible Ag has 1,800 chemicals that have been approved by the USDA and the FDA, and they are on a list approved by our agricultural industry for use. And I don't know if this particular chemical is in that list, but I know that all of these chemicals have been thoroughly tested and approved through this Responsible Ag program. And I think our local ag workers and owners here in the Central Coast have been quite responsible, and we want them to be successful, so we have to be careful about how much we restrict them.
Jimmy.
Yeah, no, look, I think methyl bromide has been an issue. If you grew up here, you understand how much of an issue it's been for the people here on the Central Coast. We have a very big farming community, and you're right, it is the number one industry in this area. And for a while there, they relied on methyl bromide, but they slowly phased it out, and they should and will continue to phase it out. But in order to do that, you need research on what can replace it. And that's why we're fortunate enough to have a research station right here in the Salinas Valley that was supported by Congressman Sam Farr, because we need research into our specialty crops. We can't have research in crops in the Midwest. You don't understand how different that farming is than the farming here in the Central Coast. We just can't send a machine through, some combines through, and pick the wheat and the flax. No, we have to have workers come in here who deal with the strawberries, pick the raspberries, cut the lettuce. It's very labor intensive, and therefore they're exposed to methyl bromide. And that's why we know we have to phase it out to stop exposing our farm workers to it. And we can do that by doing the research necessary. That research station is vital to this area. It's vital to the specialty crops in this area. It's vital to the industry here. And I look forward to continuing the funding necessary to make sure it's maintained. Right now, Congressman Farr has a bill that I think he put forward $30 million to get 25 more scientists in here to do that research. They want to actually redo it. It's an old building. It's pretty dilapidated. They want to have, I think it's going to cost $100 million to do it. And that's been the bill that's been proposed. I look forward to making sure that research station continues to exist and continues to help out our number one industry here on the Central Coast and continues to help out the people, the farm workers, and the farmers who contribute to it.
So you're talking about research. It's a perfect segue to my question about researching marijuana. Arguably one of Sam Farr's legacies will be the work that he's done advocating to at least open up federal awareness of marijuana to be consistent with states like California. He this year introduced a bill that would create a new schedule. Some of you may know about Schedule I drugs, the most closely, you know, controlled substances, and it would make a new classification, 1R, that would let researchers get easier access to marijuana, do research on its medicinal benefits and other things. He also introduced a bill that would restrict the Department of Justice from using its funds to block states from restricting, from implementing their own medical marijuana laws. Do you support, first, removing marijuana from the list of Schedule I drugs? Second, do you support restricting the DOJ from using its money to stop states from enforcing their own state laws? Let's start with Jimmy on this one. Two-part question.
Look, I think I'm the only one seated up here that's actually prosecuted a marijuana case. And let me tell you, as a prosecutor, they are the worst cases to try. And I'll tell you why. The law behind it here in California, it's confusing, it's inconsistent. And so what happens with that? You get juries and jurors who are confused and inconsistent. And it's been too long now that the federal government has basically said, leave it up to the states, leave it up to the states. Well, let me tell you, the state has acted. The states have acted with Colorado, Washington, and this November, California. And it is incumbent on the federal government to make sure we have a consistent law. And yes, that starts by descheduling marijuana. Yet we need the research to do that. I don't know if, and Sarah mentioned that. Marijuana is a Schedule I drug. That means it's right there with heroin and PCP and ecstasy. Schedule II is cocaine and methamphetamine. If you can believe that, it's higher than those two drugs. If the scheduling was done nowadays, it wouldn't be even be on the schedule, I believe. And that's why I appreciate Congressman Sam Farr putting forward the bill that Sarah mentioned. Right now, the only university that can research marijuana for the government is the University of Mississippi. And they can only use their marijuana. Sam Farr put forward this bill saying, no. We need to open it up to other entities to do the research, and we need to make sure we have a diverse supply, because some of you may not know, all marijuana is not the same. It's different, and you need to have that appropriate research to do that. So it's up to the feds it's time for them to step up when it comes for making sure it's off that schedule and making sure that they come up with a consistent law that everybody in all of our states can follow.
And before we go to Casey, what about the DOJ? Do you support the idea of restricting the DOJ from using its funds to enforce federal law in states that have different laws?
Yeah, no, look, like I said, I understand that. I mean, once again, you know, you would hear about these federal prosecutions of cases, and jurors would hear about it, and they would be sitting in a state court going, why am I here when they're doing this, when they're prosecuting it, or they're not prosecuting it? It's very confusing. And so I do think that there shouldn't be federal funds to enforce or prosecute those marijuana crimes, because it's going to get descheduled, it should get descheduled, and it's going to become legalized. But we just need to have a consistency behind that.
Casey.
Thank you. I think we're talking about medicinal marijuana, but I'm not entirely sure. But I actually do agree that medicinal marijuana, I agree with its legalization, and that it should be considered a Schedule II drug, not Schedule I or even Schedule I-R. The problem with Schedule I and even a 1-R is the restrictions on banking and any banks that, you know, right now we have a lot of legal entrepreneurs who are engaged in medicinal marijuana. They try to do banking, they do all of their banking in cash, and it's either not FDIC insured or it raises red flags for money laundering. And so it does require a change within the Department of Justice and within the schedule to change it to a Schedule II drug.
Before we move away from this topic, a quick answer on this one. Sam Farr voted no on subjecting federal employees to random drug testing. Where do you stand on that? Yes or no, that there should be random drug testing?
Yes, there should be.
Yes, but I mean, that's a tough question to answer in the sense that it depends on the position as well.
Why? So for some federal employees, is that?
Yeah, I mean, you gotta be, I mean, look, I don't mind the drug testing, but I think it's more important to have drug testing when you have specific jobs and duties that can, you know, where they're dealing with the safety of other people.
I'd like each of you to talk about, on the issue of climate change, what specific policies would you put forth? What is Congress doing right now that is in the right direction or the wrong direction? What would you advocate for as far as climate change? Let's start with Casey this time.
Yes. The good news is I'm a Republican who believes in climate change. I know that that may be rare, but I do believe in climate change. I think we are seeing the impacts of climate change, and I also believe that we have a responsibility to mitigate the impact of climate change. I'm also a vegetarian, so I'm doing my own part to not contribute to global warming and greenhouse gas emission through factory farms, which is the number one emitter. So last year was the Paris Climate Accord, and I actually think that it was hailed as a great success for climate change, but it actually had a lot of deficiencies, and I think the U.S. government could do much better to focus domestically on how to mitigate the impacts of climate change. So for example, we committed about $38 billion after the Paris Climate Agreement, but it only addressed CO2 emissions. It didn't address methane emissions. It didn't address nitrous oxide. Both of those are actually, they warm the atmosphere faster than CO2 emissions. It didn't address factory farming. It didn't address rising sea levels. I mean, there are all of these things that were missing from that agreement, not to mention that it's unenforceable for all of the countries that signed on. I believe that we should actually focus more here at home on how we can do better to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I think we can do that by having the Department of Energy take the lead and really make a concerted effort toward alternative energy.
Jimmy?
The first thing is we need leadership in Washington, D.C. that is not in denial and accepts the fact that there is climate change going on, okay? I mean, we have melting Arctic caps, we have melting Antarctic caps, we have melting streets in India because of the warming that's going on. And part of that is because of the output in our carbon output that is created by man. And that's a carbon output that is going to affect not just people across the world, but especially right here on the Central Coast. Rising sea levels, I mean, you hear about these reports, it seems like every month now, they're getting worse and worse. I think the latest one is that the oceans are going to rise 3 to 5 feet by 2100. That's going to affect thousands and thousands of people right here on the Central Coast. And so what's the plan? Are we resilient? Do we start replacing roads and septic tanks and sewer pipes? Do we deal with something of a plan of retreat? Is that what we're going to have to do? I think we need to have task forces that deal with that. Fortunately, the Coastal Commission, within the past 6 months, allocated $200,000 so that Monterey Bay can have a plan to deal with rising sea levels. They're gonna map it out, they're gonna see where it's gonna affect first. But I think we need to look beyond here. The Netherlands are dealing with flooding, and they've been dealing with it a long time. They have this program called DeltaWorks, where it provides architectural and economic jobs for people to prevent the flooding in their area. And that's something we need to look at. We also need to constrain our carbon output, okay? We need to implement President Obama's Clean Power Plan. Right now it's held up in the courts, but get it out of the courts so we can cut our carbon by 30% by 2030. And yes, we need to help the Paris Agreement. We need to push that forward. So it's not just us taking the lead on this, but all countries taking a part in constraining our carbon output. And there needs to be a pivot to renewables, okay? We need to pivot to renewables. Solar, wave and tidal energy, geothermal energy, wind power. We need to focus on that. We focus it on nationally, especially here, right here in California. California is number one in solar use. They're number one in geothermal use. They're number two in wind power. We have the capabilities. California, again, is led, and we're doing it right here on the Central Coast. The Pinoche Valley and the other plant down there in South Monterey County, there are solar plants that are going into effect right now here locally. It's an issue that we need to deal with, not just in Washington, D.C. We need to deal with it globally, domestically, in California, and right here in this community. And I look forward to being a part of a Democratic Congress, Democratic representation that accepts that and is willing to deal with the issue.
We're running out of time here. I want to ask about health care. Rate the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. And is it working? Is it working well? And also, if you can address rising health care costs. We've seen it, you know, we hear about it certainly reporting in our paper from all these different public agencies that are negotiating contracts, and health care costs have skyrocketed, and they have for private employers as well. What do you propose to do about those costs? We'll start with Jimmy on this one.
Yeah, look, I think the Affordable Care Act, it is something that had the goal of making sure that more people were insured. And let me tell you, we've met that goal. 19 million more people are insured. Okay, 90% of America is insured. They accept pre-existing health conditions. There's no cap on what the insurance can or can't spend. Here in Monterey County, the rate of insured has dropped. It used to be, Monterey County used to be 57 out of 58. The rate of uninsured has dropped from 21% to 9% thanks to the Affordable Care Act. It's met that goal in making sure more people are insured. But let me tell you, I get it. There's a lot more work that needs to be done on the ACA. It's very difficult. When I'm out there in the district talking to doctors and patients, it's difficult and it's expensive. And that's why you hear these insurance companies, Aetna and United Health, dropping out. We don't have enough younger, healthier people insured, and therefore we can't use them to take care of the more sicker, frailer people that the insurance companies are having to use. So what's happening is they're spending all their money on the sick, on people who are sick, not being able to obtain any other money. So basically that's why insurance companies are dropping out. That's why younger, healthier people are going, why would I be a part of that? Something that's more expensive and gives me less benefits because there's less competition going on in the industry. And so there's short-term fixes that can be done, such as getting rid of the Cadillac tax, making it easier to report, making sure the pharmaceutical benefit managers are more transparent in obtaining their drugs. And there's long-term fixes, making sure there are incentives for younger, healthier people to be involved, to have skin in the game to have that insurance, making sure that there are incentives, possibly penalties, so that people sign up, stay signed up, and hopefully create a system that helps that helps everybody, and that we can meet our goals. It's tough. I mean, you talk to people. A story I had, I met with an emergency room doctor.
I'm going to cut you off before the story, just so we can keep moving. Go to Casey on this one.
Yes. The Affordable Care Act, good intentions, but this is the perfect illustration of how broken Washington, D.C. is. And this is what happens when you try to force legislation through from one party instead of seeking a bipartisan solution. And this is why I think it's so important to really work across the parties, work across the aisle to try to get things done and make sure that we have the right legislation that's passed. The number of people who have been insured now as a result of the Affordable Care Act is still quite low. In fact, there are still 33 million people who are not insured in this country. So Jimmy thinks it's okay, it's working, even though he's only willing to help about 1 in 4 Americans, because there's still a third of those individuals who aren't receiving health care as a result. And those who do have coverage are seeing their premiums increase, and doctors are leaving the field because their reimbursement rates are being lowered. So what's happened is, not only does this just illustrate poor legislation, but it also illustrates the power of the insurance companies and the power of the drug companies, which really influenced Congress when they were passing this legislation. And so I believe what we have to do is we can make some tweaks to it, we can fix the family glitch, we can fix the Cadillac tax, but we really need to look at overhauling the Affordable Care Act. And one way that we do that is to try to get the insurance companies and the drug companies out of the way, and then look at the 10 MECs. So the MECs are the minimal essential coverage requirements. There are 10 of them. And this is why all of you, male or female, have to have coverage for a pap smear. Whether you have children or not, you have to have coverage for pediatric dental. I mean, this is why people have to buy larger insurance packages, which are more expensive, which doesn't even really meet their needs. I think we need to get that list of 10 down to 2. And the 2 need to focus on catastrophic coverage and preventative care. And once we get those 2, we can make sure that every American has healthcare that is affordable and is accessible.
So, Casey, when the inevitable, you know, zillionth round of voting on whether to repeal the Affordable Care Act comes to you if you're elected, which Republicans continue bringing forth, do you vote yes to repeal?
No.
Or you vote no, keep it in place?
That's right. I would not repeal the Affordable Care Act because I haven't heard anyone that has come up with a viable alternative. So maybe if there is a viable alternative, I would be open to that, but I haven't heard that. As a result, I think what the Republicans are touting, which is, you know, repeal and replace, I don't think that's going to work. But also what the Democrats are saying is let's expand this into a single payer system. I also don't think we can afford that as a nation. We need to take the plan that we have and make it work.
And do what we like to call a speed round, which is very, very short answers. Yes, yes or no answers to these questions, in fact. Should Judge Merrick Garland get a hearing on his nomination to the Supreme Court right now? If you were there, should he get a hearing? Yes.
Absolutely.
Or no?
Yes, but the Senate decides, not the House.
It's a little bit hypothetical. That's the warm-up question. Should California voters say yes to Prop 64 legalizing recreational marijuana? Yes or no?
No.
Yes, because it will force the federal government to get off their cans and do something about it.
Should Monterey County voters say yes to Measure Z, which is a ban on fracking and wastewater injection and oil operations? Jimmy?
Look, if there
yes or
is no...
It's a yes or no.
On,
we're out of time here.
No. Look.
Or you just tell us how you're voting, yes or no.
No. Look, in regards to fracking... hold on a second. As you know, that bill is not just about fracking, okay? If it was just about fracking, I'd say, you bet. We are not going to have fracking here on the Central Coast. No way, okay? In such seismically sensitive area as the Salinas Valley and with the San Andreas Fault back down there, no way is there going to be fracking here on the Central Coast. And when I heard about that bill, I said, you bet, I'm all for it. But then I heard there were other things that were involved in it, and I need to make sure that we know exactly what we're voting on besides just the fact that it entails no fracking.
Casey?
No, because there are broader implications for that bill.
California voters also decide this election day on the death penalty, Prop 62. Should voters end the death penalty in California? Casey?
No.
Yes.
Finally, you disagree on one of these. It's working. Regarding abortion, here's my yes or no question for you. There's all this talk about the Hyde Amendment, repealing the Hyde Amendment. That's the amendment that blocks us from using federal funds, insurance, to pay for abortions. Should we repeal the Hyde Amendment? Yes or no? Jimmy?
There should be federal funding for that, definitely.
Casey?
I agree.
All right. Here's another one where I think you might agree. The plastic bag ban, yes or no?
Yes.
Yes, and I want to say I'm proud to be a member of the PG City Council. We were the first city in Monterey County to pass the plastic bag ban.
So before we open it to audience questions, I want to hear each of you just briefly tell us what's your dream law that you would love to introduce if you're elected and you can, you know, just roll it out. What would your law be? What would it achieve? Let's start with Casey.
So right now, obviously, one of the important issues in this district is water. And we need a new source of water. We also need federal funding for water. And there has been a bill that was introduced by Dianne Feinstein. It has a really long title, but essentially it is the Drought Recovery and Relief Act. And I think it's essentially important that that bill get passed through the House. It's working its way through the Senate right now, but essentially what that bill would do, it would allow federal funding, especially for the Pure Water Monterey project. It would also streamline the permitting process, which is important because right now we have 9 federal agencies involved in our local water permitting process, which is very cumbersome, which means it takes years and millions of dollars to get anything done at the local level. And then it would also, it also addresses the Endangered Species Act and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to give autonomy back to the local water districts and water agencies here on the Central Coast. And I would work really hard with my counterparts to make sure that we get that bill passed in the House.
Her counterparts, she's got to work with her own party. All the Republicans in the Central Valley are completely against that bill, unfortunately. And that's going to be difficult, okay? That's what we need to realize. We've talked about it before. You talk with farmers out there in Salinas, in the Pajaro Valley, they will tell you water is an issue. There's no doubt about it. But what's the most pressing issue? That's making sure that we can have people here to contribute to this community, contribute to my production. We've talked about comprehensive immigration reform. Nothing would make me happier if we had a president willing to do it, a speaker who's willing to roll up his sleeves and get things done, and I'd be honored to play a part in making sure that we contribute to families, farm workers, and farmers in passing comprehensive immigration reform.
All right, my last speed round question. Who are you voting for president? Jimmy.
That's easy. Hillary Clinton.
Casey.
So Jimmy doesn't disagree with anything about Hillary Clinton. I disagree with pretty much everything from all of the presidential candidates. I've said publicly I'm not supporting Donald Trump. I'm also not supporting Hillary Clinton. And I'm hoping that Gary Johnson will be able to participate in the debate so that we can actually see what his policy positions are. And honestly, I feel like we are at a point in our nation where we need a third party.
Let me address that. Last week, my opponent was at a high school where she said she is voting for Gary Johnson. Let me tell you what Gary Johnson stands for in the Libertarian Party. Repeal of all gun laws, repeal of all environmental protection laws, repeal of Social Security, repeal of basically all of our taking back our alliances that we set out, that we worked so hard to do. That's the candidate that support that is running for that party. You need to know that we're having a representative who's willing to vote for that type of president. I vote for Hillary Clinton because she has put forward policies and put forward the effort that she can hopefully get things done in Washington, D.C. She's going to try to do that. She's not just going to go there to do nothing. She's going to go there to get something done. That's why I support her.
All right, so now we're going to open it up to audience questions.
You can listen to that audience question and answer session on our website, kazu.org. This debate took place Monday, September 19th at the Press Club in Seaside. It was hosted by the Monterey County Weekly and was recorded by 90.3 KAZU.